Hello, welcome to Stars, Cells, and God, the show where we discuss new discoveries taking place at the frontiers of science that have theological and philosophical implications, as well as discoveries that point to the reality of God's existence. My name is Jeff Zwerink. I'll be your guide today as we talk about brain development and exoplanets. But before we get into the discussion, I want to encourage you to subscribe to our channel, Reasons to Believe, so that you can be notified of our new weekly videos. Learn more at reasons.org. Are by following us on social media at RTB_official. Today I'm joined with Fuzz. Fuzz, good to have you here today.
Jeff.
I'm going to let you start off the discussion talking about brain development. So what do we have in tap today?
Yeah. Well, you know, Jeff, to set the stage, there are all these adages, you know, that people throw around. Some of them are helpful. Some of them maybe not so much. But one adage that's applicable to today's discovery is this idea that good things take time. And, you know, that's definitely true when it comes to whiskey, by the way. Now, I don't drink. I'd imagine you don't drink.
I've had occasional things. There's part of me that doesn't quite understand why people drink this stuff because it hurts when you first start drinking it.
Yeah. Well, I don't drink, but good whiskey takes time.
Right.
And, you know, in fact, you can make whiskey in about a week. Just the process of fermenting the grains and then distilling the alcohol from the grains, you could do that in a week's time. But if you want really fine whiskey, you have to age the whiskey, usually in barrels. And as a chemist, I find the whole chemistry of the aging process to be fascinating, you know, because 3 years seems to be the window of time for at least an acceptable whiskey. And it depends upon the oak barrel, where you get the oak from, how you treat the oak. And so there's a real art and a science to, you know, to aging whiskey. And what happens is during the aging process, the walls of the barrel will absorb impurities in the alcohol, high molecular weight materials, which actually improve the flavor, improve the smoothness. There's a little bit of evaporation of the alcohol that takes some of the edge off the whiskey. Okay. And then there's materials in the oak barrel that infuse into the whiskey and give it its color and give it its distinct flavor. And so it's a fascinating aging process. And 25 years is the optimum time for the best whiskey.
Really, 25 years. So I'm gathering, is that you made it sound like there are things that diffuse from the barrel into the whiskey, from the whiskey into the barrel. Is that more just physical, like adding salt to something, or are there chemical changing of the actual physical molecules?
It's probably some just leaching and diffusion and absorption. Okay. But there may be some chemical processes that are taking place as well.
All right.
So there's a whole science to the aging process of whiskey that's, you know, very interesting chemistry. But another place where good things take time has to do with brain development, and specifically the cellular processes that take place in progenitor cells and neural cells play a role in the development of something called the neocortex. And it turns out that those cellular processes take longer in the developing modern human brain than they would have taken place in the brains of Neanderthals. And this is an insight that was made available by a team of German researchers who published a paper recently in the journal Science as part of the Science Advances feature. But this is part of a larger project among anthropologists to try to understand what makes us unique, if anything, as human beings. And, you know, part of that process involves comparing, you know, our anatomical features with those of Neanderthals and the other hominins. But thanks to this whole industry of ancient DNA studies now, people can actually we've been able to sequence the Neanderthal genome, the genomes of Denisovans. We have high-quality sequences available. And we can then compare gene sequences of the Neanderthal genome with that of modern humans. And
How much of the Neanderthal and Denisovan DNA do we have? Do we have something equivalent to what we have in humans? Because I don't think we have the human genome entirely sequenced.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and that's right. We don't have the entire sequence of the human genome. We have, you know, probably close to, I would think about 90 to 95% now.
Okay.
And it would be comparable with, with the Neanderthal and the Denisovan Jones, genomes. And we also have high quality sequences, meaning that the sequence, the genome has been sequenced multiple times.
Okay.
And so, you know, every time you sequence the genome, you, you know, you actually improve the quality of the sequence because, you know, if you sequence a genome 10 times, if there's a couple of errors that took place in the sequencing, you will be able to detect them the more times you sequence it.
How does that impact, you know, so if you were to take a DNA from a single person, I can see where you're going to get errors in sequencing and you want to get that genome, but there are differences from person to person. I assume that plays into sequencing for Neanderthals and Denisovans as well.
Right. It does. And, you know, part of the human genome program or sequencing program is to assess diversity of the human genome. Mm-hmm. You can't quite do that with Neanderthals and Denisovans, but we do have multiple genomes from multiple specimens.
Okay, so you're not getting just one. There is some measure of that diversity as well as being able to pair out the
errors. And there you're now looking at, you know, specimens from different locations as well as specimens that lived at different times.
Right, okay.
So your genetic diversity is a snapshot from population and time.
Right.
So it's a good assessment of diversity, you know, even though it's not the numbers aren't that high.
Right, gotcha.
But people have looked at the differences in the human and Neanderthal genomes for the protein coding genes. So there's about, you know, 19, 20,000 genes that are encoded in both sets of genomes and have found only 100 positional differences in those those proteins. But the question is, are those 100 differences significant? And so now there's a project underway to actually experimentally assess, you know, what those differences entail.
So those differences are like different letters in the genetic code that impact what sort of proteins are made?
So the gene that codes for a particular protein may have one amino acid that's different in the human genome compared to that of Neanderthals.
Okay, all right.
And so that then becomes the basis for trying to make an assessment. And in the past, people have basically looked at the differences and tried to understand if those differences would have significant impact just by the identity and the role that gene plays. So, for example, in one set of comparisons, there are three proteins that seem to have a unique amino acid sequence in humans compared to Neanderthals, Denisovans, and even chimps.
Okay.
And these three proteins, just for the sake of completeness, are K1F18A, KNL1, and SPAG5. So that's the last time.
Biochemists are about as original in their names as the astronomers are.
Yeah, so. Guilty. That's the last time I'm going to mention those proteins specifically, but all three of them are involved in cell division. Mm-hmm. And they particularly are involved in the process of cell division where the chromosomes are segregated from each other. And these proteins are expressed at very high levels in the developing neocortex. And so the thought is that these may be significant differences that could explain potentially differences in human and Neanderthal cognition.
Okay.
And just for a bit of background, this is kind of a very crude, or simplistic presentation of the brain where you see different regions. And there are three regions that people talk about: the reptilian brain, which is instinctual. This is the portion of the brain that you see in reptiles.
So this would be a human brain would have all this, but
this
they've
is
got
a human
these
brain.
Ones that they designate different
right.
areas.
Right. Well, and then when you look, like for example, reptiles don't have the mammalian portion of the brain or the neocortex.
All right.
And so they've identified these three regions that they think may have some kind of evolutionary significance too.
Okay.
So there's a reptilian brain, the mammalian brain, and then the neocortex, which is where cognition, language, sensory perception, spatial reasoning, things like that take place. And here's a cartoon showing the kind of the differences in the brains. And what you see is that in reptiles and in fish, there isn't the mammalian portion of the brain. We don't see the neocortex. In mice, you have the mammalian portion of the brain, but there's a very small neocortex. And as you go up the chain of being, you know, like the rhesus monkey and the chimpanzee have increasingly larger neocortexes. And then in humans, we have the largest neocortex. Mm-hmm. The neocortex of Neanderthals was also quite large as well, comparable in size. So the question is there something fundamentally different about our neocortex and that of Neanderthals? And because these proteins are involved in cell division, it's probably worth just reviewing the cell cycle, and then we'll talk about some very interesting experiments that they did. But here's a diagram showing the cell cycle. And we begin with right after cell division takes place. You have these two daughter cells, and the first phase of the cell cycle is called G1. It's the growth phase. There's growth mm-hmm. that takes place in the cell. And then the G1 phase gives way to what's called the S phase, where DNA is synthesized. And so what happens at that point is that the chromosomes become duplicated in the cell. And then after the S1 phase is completed, there's another growth phase that leads into the cell division process. And the first phase is called the prophase. Here, the nucleus dissolves and the chromosomes condense into these visible structures. Uh-huh. Usually they're in a diffuse state in the nucleus. The metaphase, which is what we're going to be talking a lot about here, is the phase where the chromosomes line up in the midplane of the cell. And sometimes it's called the metaphase plane. And then the anaphase is when the chromosomes segregate to the opposite sides of the cell or the opposite cell poles. Mm-hmm. The telophase is where the nucleus reforms. Then cytokinesis is where the cells divide apart. And then you repeat that process again. And so during the course of neocortex development, there would be these cells called progenitor cells, neural stem cells, that are undergoing this cell division process. They're proliferating mm. to create the cell mass to build the neocortex. And so because these three proteins, again, are involved in the cell division and particularly in the cell separation process, they thought that maybe these proteins may have play some role in the quality of the cell division process. Mm-hmm. And this is where the whiskey metaphor comes into play, because it turns out people have discovered that the longer that a cell stays in the metaphase stage, the more time you give for the chromosomes to align in the midplane.
Okay.
And so it just takes time for those chromosomes to line up, and you end up having fewer chromosomal separation errors that take place if you have a longer metaphase. If the metaphase,
so what would be a chromosomal separation error? Because presumably the chromosomes are not joined right. particularly. I'm looking at the diagram trying right. to figure out there. It looks like they've kind of got this central point where they're connected,
right.
and then they're splitting from that. What sort of errors happen?
If you don't get things perfectly aligned when the anaphase begins, what will end up happening is you won't get two sets of chromosomes in the daughter cell. One will have an incomplete set, and the other will have extra chromosomes in it.
Really separate completely, or you're right. just going to get mixing. Right. Gotcha.
Right. So, what these researchers did to test this idea was to use an interesting technology. That involves the creation of brain organoids and then gene editing technologies. And this research group actually has done a series of experiments along these lines. There's at least three papers published. This is the second. There's a third paper that was just published that I'm working through right now. And in fact, in the very first episode of Star Cells and God, we talked about work that this team did, assessing the NOVA1 gene. But the idea here is that you can create these cell cultures called brain organoids, where you take induced pluripotent stem cells, you culture them in a cell culture into a three-dimensional cell culture as opposed to a two-dimensional one on a petri dish through using a spinning bioreactor very, very slowly turns. And it takes a few months for these brain organoids to develop. But depending upon the types of growth factors, the culture conditions, you can get these brain organoids to develop into analogs to different regions of the brain. And the greater the proliferation of cell types and the greater structures that you see. So these are very powerful tools that can be used to study aspects of brain development. So what they did in their experiments is they actually grew brain organoids for chimps, and they grew brain organoids for humans in the first set of experiments. And the three proteins that are involved in cell division that have a unique amino acid sequence in modern humans, those proteins have a unique sequence in modern humans, but the chimpanzee version of those genes is the same as in Neanderthals and in Denisovans.
Okay.
So they grew chimp and human brain organoids, and they compared the cell division cycle for what are called apical progenitor cells. These are cells that are developing into neurons and macroglia and stuff in the neocortex. And what they saw is that the metaphase was longer in the brain, in the cells from the human brain organoids,
okay,
than it was in chimps, and that there were fewer examples of lagging chromosomes during anaphase. So it looks as if, you know, that particular set of proteins that have, again, a unique amino acid sequence in humans seem to slow down metaphase, which means that the quality of the cells produced in cell division is going to be higher, so that the quality of the neural cells in the neocortex of humans are higher quality cells. They're less diseased, they're less defective because of this chromosomal separation error.
So presumably the DNA segments that they're using to develop the brain, or the cells that have the stem cells that produce the brain organoids, have this particular segment that has the difference, and not a whole lot else that would be different.
Yes.
Because it seems like there might be multiple things that play into that.
Right.
But somehow they've controlled to make sure that this is what's actually affecting the development, correct?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
And then the next set of experiments is they humanized mice brains. So they took they used CRISPR gene editing in mouse cells, and they were able to convert the mouse version of those three proteins into the human version. And then they looked at what happened in the brain development for mice. Now, mice have a very small neocortex, but they do have a neocortex. And they saw there that when they humanized those proteins in the mouse brain, that the metaphase slowed down and there were fewer lagging chromosomes in anaphase compared to the brain development in wild type mice.
Right.
They then did another
experiment. Why could you not go in and do the same sort of experiment where you're doing that with the chimpanzee brain? Is that because you need to actually have the chimpanzees grow to do that, or?
Yeah. So this was done in mice, actual mice.
Right. Not just developing organoids or something.
Yeah, right. Then what they did is they took the human stem cells that they used to develop human brain organoids, and they Neanderthalized them.
Okay.
And they converted those three proteins into the Neanderthal version. And when they compared the cell division process in the apical stem cells versus the humans versus the Neanderthalized versions, they saw that in Neanderthalized versions, that again, cell division was more rapid, less time was spent in metaphase, more chromosome lagging errors, or more lagging chromosomes, I should say, in the anaphase. So it looks as if what these three amino acid differences are telling us is that the human brain was probably a higher quality brain, where, you know, it was a more robust brain, which could very well translate into differences in cognition.
Well, there's some of that makes sense. I mean, you know, when you think of the difference between I've got a Model T Ford and a Formula One sports car, you know, at least some of that is you can tolerate a whole lot more. And slop's not the right word, but a whole lot more imprecision in the way parts are made. You get up to an F1 car right. or a Formula One car or an Indy car, and it's like everything's got to be made to these exacting tolerances. Right. It sounds like that sort of thing is going on here, that these sorts of things allow the human brain to do something more, or is it right. that they cause the
Well,
human
I mean,
brain?
I think the analogy – that was a great analogy, by the way. I think the analogy would be you have a Formula One sports car that is high precision – and mm-hmm. one that somebody worked on and they were sloppy.
Okay.
And so the Neanderthal brain would correspond to the Formula One car where people were sloppy.
Okay.
Versus the human brain where people were very careful and you have this high precision machine. So I think that's the appropriate analogy would be.
Okay. Does that mean God's being sloppy with it?
Yeah. No, it doesn't mean that. But
right. Okay. I get what
But I mean, to your point, yeah. if that creature doesn't, as part of its characteristic, have, advanced cognition, then you don't need to have that high precision in the developmental process. You know, now this study isn't in isolation, but it's part of other studies that have shown also significant, or at least amino acids differences in other proteins that are involved in neural development. Now, there's only been, again, a few studies that have been done with the brain organoids to actually go in and check, is there a real physiological consequence to those differences mm-hmm. in amino acid sequences? But the fact that we do see a number of other proteins that are involved in brain development that show, amino acid differences suggests that this isn't just in isolation, that there are genetic differences between humans and Neanderthals that seem to have consequences in terms of brain development and cognition. And as I mentioned in the first episode of Star Cells and God, we talked about similar experiments where people were looking at the NOVA1 gene. And this is a gene that is also involved in brain development, and that the sequence for the NOVA1 gene is in humans is unique compared to Neanderthals, Denisovans, and chimps. Mm-hmm. And they saw differences in brain organoid development by simply modifying or by Neanderthalizing the NOVA1 gene okay. in human, in human brain organoids. And of course, there's also other anatomical studies that show differences in the brain structure of Neanderthals as well. So the whole point is this, is that there's a growing body of data that says there really are biological differences between the human brain and the Neanderthal brain. The sizes are comparable, but the brain shape of the human brain is distinct. That supports advanced cognition. We see differences in key genes that are involved in neurodevelopment. And we're now generating experimental data with these brain organoids that are indicating that those genetic differences are meaningful. They seem to have consequences in the way the human brain developed compared to Neanderthals. So all of this is really making a case for human exceptionalism, that we can show, that anatomically, developmentally, genetically, that humans seem to have advanced cognition, which means that it supports the idea that we are distinct from other creatures. And if we can show that humans are exceptional, that now allows us to make a scientific case for the image of God, because the idea is that humans uniquely bear God's image, and because we bear God's image, we can enter uniquely into a special type of relationship mm-hmm. with God. We have certain responsibilities that we can uniquely fulfill with respect to the creation. And so anything that makes a case for human exceptionalism and distinguishes us as human beings as unique is something that could be, appropriated for a scientific case for the image of God. So this study, supports the RTB human origins mm-hmm. model, which says, again, humans and Neanderthals would be distinct, where humans are cognitively superior. But it also, again, builds a case for human exceptionalism.
It was fascinating discussion or a fascinating discovery just about, one, how do you actually do the experiments that demonstrate that are pretty fascinating to me. Two questions that come up in my mind. One is, trying to put this discovery in and integrate it with another discovery that I know you've talked about a lot and I've thought about is where you've talked about how the genetic code is optimized to minimize errors.
Yeah.
And one of the aspects that comes up in that optimization or that error correction is that substituting letters so that you get different amino acids, very often that'll have a different amino acid that effectively produces either the same protein or a protein that does almost identical stuff. I'm just wrestling with this, you know, because we're talking about three different amino acids here out of a fairly long stretch, I would presume, that I guess I'm struggling to see how can this error correction – is this just a place where the error correction – I could see the argument being made. This is a place where the error correction wasn't quite good, and that's what allowed humans to develop this new thing.
Right.
And I guess I'm just kind of off the top of my head trying to figure out how to integrate those two. What are your thoughts on how do these two discoveries play?
Yeah, well, you know, in the code is optimized for error minimization but it doesn't mean that when you have amino acid substitutions that in some instances they can be biologically significant. So if they are at a key, you know, location within the protein, you know, changing one amino acid for another can have significant, you know, functional consequences. And so these amino acid differences are I mean, those three proteins still function in the same way, you know, so the function isn't compromised. It's just that those changes wind up slowing down the metaphase process, right? And so it's slowing it down just enough that it ensures that the cell division takes place with a higher degree of fidelity. So it's not even like a loss of function. It's just the function is altered slightly. And the big question is that slight alteration significant or not? And that becomes highly speculative when you're just looking at the sequences, or even when you're trying to build protein when you're trying to model protein structures, you know, and say, well, maybe there are some structural differences that might be significant. Here, you're able to go in and do experimental work, you know, in a fairly interesting model system that identifies that this is really different. So
it does seem like the fact that the genetic code is so good at minimizing errors almost makes the fact that there are these errors, if they were errors indeed, or these differences, are not just errors, if you will. That there's you could make an argument that strikes towards intentionality because there are things that would correct it and get it back to.
Right.
But these become key to what makes humans different than Neanderthals. That strikes me.
Yeah, that's a really good point in terms of intentionality, Jeff. And along those lines, I mean, it's interesting that again the amino acid sequence in humans is unique compared to not only Neanderthals, but also Denisovans, to chimpanzees, to mice. So all mammals have basically the same amino acid sequence for these three proteins, right? And you would argue that because of that, it probably means that these are critical proteins, that any change in the amino acid sequence is going to be weeded out by natural selection, because those changes are going to compromise the function of those proteins, which is, if they're playing a role in cell division, that's devastating.
Right.
And here we have, you know, these differences in these three proteins in humans that seem to have very significant biological consequences.
Right.
So it's a bit eerie or a bit odd that you would see. It would be one thing if it'd be another thing altogether if we saw variation in these proteins throughout, you know, throughout the mammalian realm,
right?
But we don't.
Gotcha. Right? Yeah. Okay. So the other question I had is, you know, you were talking about human exceptionalism, and I think of, at least as I've read scripture, what distinguishes humanity from all the other creatures is that we're image bearers, as a, in a way that no other creature is. And you know, given that God created the universe, brought all the new stuff into existence there, that there's this nephesh creatures, you know, which has a discussion beyond our discussion today. And then there's, you know, humanity is made in God's image. It almost looks like that's a relational capacity we have with God. Does it's almost like a, you could almost argue that that's not a physical or not need not be a physical thing. So how important is it, or how critical is it to RTB's model that humans have physical exceptionalism as opposed to maybe a spiritual exceptionalism? Does the question make sense?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the way I look at it, and there very well could be theologians that would disagree with me. I mean, there's three different models for the image of God. One is structuralism, where it actually is that we have distinct capacities that separate us from other creatures. One is the relational view, where it's just simply describing our relationship.
Okay.
The other is called the functional view, or the representative view, where it's referring to a responsibilities that we've been given. But people like Bill Craig, and I would agree with this argument, make the point that in order to be unique in our capacity to have a relationship with God, or to be uniquely suited to serve a functional role in creation, there has to be something fundamentally distinct about us that gives us that capacity. So his argument is that, you know, you have to adopt some form of structuralism, even if you had adopt one of those other two views, or that the structural view kind of umbrellas those other two views. That, not that they're mutually exclusive, right?
And so this wouldn't be, oh, we found evidence for the image of God. We found evidence for the changes in structure that we would expect if we're created in God's image.
Yes, exactly. Okay. Yeah, and to me, you know, we are physical and we are, you know, immaterial.
Mm-hmm.
The image of God is part of our immaterial makeup, I would think. But it's not like we're a ghost in the machine.
Right.
There's an integration. And so you'd expect there should be something, biological systems that correspond to our uniqueness, you know, even though we would still argue that the image of God is immaterial. So kind of like a computer hardware, software analogy that to run – you know, the software, which would be analogous to the image of God, you've got to have the hardware that can handle it, right?
Right. Well, and yeah, I think there's a common error, or I've noticed in myself a tendency to distinguish the physical and the spiritual, and what I do spiritually affects my physical, what I do physically. Mm-hmm. You know, so that this idea that those are two distinct things, I think is, you're arguing that they're integrated in some fashion. Yeah. I think that makes sense. So any other final thoughts?
No, that's
well, it's fascinating to talk about.
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks for the great questions.
I find that sitting here listening, I have a wealth of questions that may not be related to your topic. Because just even going back in there, the whole process of splitting, it's like, when do you start getting the duplicate copy? Yeah, but that's not really what we were talking about. So just to kind of continue the discussion, we've had James Webb Space Telescope has been launched, and just phenomenal images and fascinating discoveries out there. And one thing that I have found is that people have talked about the James Webb. You know, there's been this whole discussion about how the James Webb has gotten rid of the notion that we live in a universe that has a beginning. And so, you know, there's this intuitive sense that the James Webb is weighing in and answering these big questions. And what I found fascinating about that particular discussion is there were some things that James Webb found that might have fit in some details better with a different model of the universe. But in a very real sense, the James Webb doesn't even impact the evidence that points towards Big Bang cosmology, because, you know, let's talk about the cosmic microwave background radiation, which the James Webb has no capacity to observe. And so there's, you know, it was conflated in what it was able, or the idea of what it was capable of doing didn't match what its specifications were. And so I see now we're interested, there's just all longstanding pervasive question of, are we alone in the universe? And we now have this new fascinating telescope. And I just kind of wanted to take a little bit of time to discuss, what is the James Webb? What is it? What can it do? And how does it weigh in on this issue of, is there life? Because the particular discovery I'm going to talk about was the first observation of an exoplanet with the James Webb Space Telescope. And so just to kind of start, I wanted to give a little bit of background of where our telescope technology has come from, because we are so used to seeing Hubble images and even the James Webb images that we think – I think there may be a distorted sense of where we've come from and how quickly we've gotten there. So if you can take a look at that first image I've got, this is an image of M100. It's a galaxy, spiral galaxy that has at the just looking at the nucleus of it, the core of it there. And this is from Kitt Peak with a 2.1 meter telescope, which is a really large telescope. I mean, that's like a 6+ foot inch optical or a primary mirror on it. So stand me up and it's taller than that. World-class telescope. And you can see this is what it was. This was kind of the state of the art in the early 90s of what we could do. And if you now go to the next image, this is the Hubble Space Telescope image of that same region. You can see it's rotated, but other than that, it's basically the same scale. And I want to point out, this was Hubble before the optics were fixed. And even before the optics were fixed, you can see just how much better the Hubble Space Telescope was. I mean, you could see stars in there. You know, the colors don't that's not a fair comparison between the two. But you can see the just the structure you see there. And now you figure out, okay, we figured out what's wrong with the Hubble. We go up, we put in optics to correct that. And now we get to its design specifications. And it's just like, you know, comparing the bottom image even to the Hubble pre-service is phenomenal, but you compare it to the Kitt Peak image and it's just like we're not even talking about the same.
Is Hubble observing in the visible?
Hubble primarily observes in the visible. It has the capacity for the ultraviolet, small capacity in the infrared. And so, you know, there's a lot of people that have talked about, oh, how much better James Webb is from the Hubble. And there's you always have to be careful about that discussion, because when you look at the James Webb, it's designed to operate in the infrared. Hubble was designed in the visible with ultraviolet and some infrared capabilities. And so they're not exactly doing the same thing. But the reality of it is Hubble, I think, is something on the order of just shy of 2 meters. I think it's 1.7 meter mirror. I'm not going to stake my reputation on that, but I think it's somewhere in that class, whereas James Webb is on the order of 6-7 meter mirror. So it's you'd just expect it to be a lot better. And if you go to the next image, you can kind of see Hubble's on the left, James Webb's on the right. You know, bearing in mind that some of that is the difference between visible and ultraviolet, but even for as good as the Hubble was, and there have been new instruments put on, and so the Hubble is even better than what I was showing there, but still, there's just a clarity, a resolution, a set of details that you can see with the Webb telescope that you just can't see with Hubble. And this is an evolution over about 30 years. So you can imagine just what we're capable of doing. Now, the downside of Webb is that it's up in space and it's got a pretty narrow field of view, and you can't build too many of those where you can put lots of telescopes down on the ground. So all of these are all necessary, but I just kind of wanted to give a picture of – look at the picture on the left compared to the picture on the right, and – our technology has really advanced. It's phenomenal what we've been able to accomplish. And even in the midst of that, I wanted to make sure we understood just how impressive the telescope technology was. James Webb still can't find a planet like Earth and take an image of it. And so that's how hard the challenge is to find a Earth-sized planet and actually get information about the planet itself more than just its gross features.
So something like James Webb can detect planets that would be like Jupiter size or super Jupiters, but when you're talking about Earth-like planets, that would be with respect to smaller rocky type planets. Is that what you're saying?
There's a couple of things that play into that. In general, Webb will be able to find Jupiter, Saturn-type objects. If you're looking close enough and the right kind of star, you might get down in the Earth size range. And so it's not it can only find this, but the bulk of what it's going to find is the Jupiter, Neptune, Saturn-type planets. And this is why. Because you ask the question, how do we find a planet around a star? And the analogy I will give to illustrate the challenge of that problem is I grew up in the Midwest, and we would go out and collect lightning bugs at night. Love doing that. You know, little things, bugs that light up, rear ends light up. I mean, who's not fascinated by that? And these little lightning bugs, there's only about an hour where you can find them, because too early in the day, they don't light up because they don't need the light because the sun's out. Too late, and you can see the light, but then you can't have any context of where they are. You can't see their bodies afterwards. And so there's this range where you can see them, you can see the light, but it's not so dark that you can't see their bodies and go find them. But they give off a relatively small amount of light. Now, contrast that with take those big honking spotlights, people shine up into the sky that say, here, come here, shop in my store, find this place. Imagine the biggest one of those that we've made, put the lightning bug on the rim of it, and say, build me a detector that can find the light from the lightning bug in the midst of that. That's the challenge.
Yeah.
Because the light from the star in the visible range is a billion times brighter than the lightning bug. The light from the star in the infrared range is a million times brighter. And so most of our telescope or our exoplanet hunting technologies have been centered around looking for variations in the light from the star, because there's a bunch of that light. Yeah. So we will take a telescope, and as a planet orbits around the star, it actually causes a gravitational wobble. And so we can find the Doppler shifting in the light from the star. That's the radial velocity technique. That was the first successful large-scale technique. I always have to preface that statement with the fact that we found a couple of planets around a pulsar, which we could find by variations in the timing of the pulsar. But when you're talking about stars that are solar or sun-like in that they're on the main sequence, then radial velocity was the technique we used. Another technique that has been very prolific is if the geometry is lined up as the star or as the planet orbits around a star, the planet will pass in front of the face of the star and it will cause the light to dim. Mm. Jupiter planets dim a planet or a star's sunlight or the star's light by about a factor of 100, Earth size by about a factor of 10,000 or 1/10,000th is how much it dims. And so by looking around very stable stars, you can find the light from the planet. We have found that's probably the most prolific technique we've used. In fact, they built an instrument called Kepler that was designed to find Earth-sized planets orbiting sun-like stars. And so it operated for about 3 years, because that's how many times you need to get a reliable detection. And then there was another technique that I'll just point out, because it can find a lot of stars, but it doesn't give you much information, is that if the light from that distant star passes by a star with a planet, then it will get gravitationally lensed and it'll have a signature to it. But again, notice all of those are looking at light from the star, not from the planet.
Right.
The kind of the holy grail of exoplanet detections is, can we build an instrument where we can see the light from the planet? And that's what the Webb telescope is doing. There are other telescopes that do this, but the idea, or the main idea, or the prevailing way of doing it is you put something, it's called a coronagraph, where you put a block in front of the star to block the light from the star so that you now can see, have sensitivity to detect the light from the planet. Just because you can't build an instrument that has sensitivity over a factor of a billion or a factor of a million. It's just almost impossible to do that. Now, the challenge with that technique is that you can block out the light from the star, but any sort of thing you put there, you still get diffraction around the thing that blocks it. And even at a factor of a million, if only 1/100,000th gets around, the amount of light coming around is still more than the star. So one of the ways this particular technique is sensitive primarily to bright star or bright planets that are very separated from their star. So this particular planet this star, and it's got a very nice descriptive astronomical name. It's HIP 65426, which means it's the 65,426th object found in the Hipparco satellite or Hipparco survey. And it's, I think, if I remember correctly, it's about 350 light years away. So it's in our near vicinity here. And the planet that it found is about 90 astronomical units. So 90 times the distance from the sun to the Earth. Pluto or Neptune's about 39, 40 astronomical units. So this is well beyond the orbits of Pluto and Neptune if this planet were to be put in our solar system, and it's got a mass of a couple times that of Jupiter. So this isn't like, ooh, we're getting close to finding an Earth-like planet. What's cool about this discovery is, one, that it shows that the James Webb Telescope can find extrasolar planets. We figured it could. We had knowing the design characteristics of what it looked like. The fascinating aspect of this discovery was not in that it found the planet, is that in the looking at the planet, the telescope was operating about 10 times better than what we thought it was. So it's a way of assessing how well is the instrument working. And if you kind of go to the next slide there, this is you can see the images of the planet in, this is seven different wave bands, and this is from 2 microns to 15 microns, which is far into the infrared. And the top left image, the purple one there, is actually in a region where we've never found exoplanets in that energy or in that wavelength range. So it's novel discovery there. In fact, it may be the first two are in that category. But what you see, again, the star is a marker of where the star is. You can see all the light's been blocked out, but you still see all of the fluctuations and the weird stuff that's going on there, but you very clearly see HIP 65426b, which is the little blob off to the left and the bottom there. And again, by seeing how well the amount of light we see, the signal to noise, we find that it's working so much better. And they talk about the different reasons why the telescope's better. And it's like it's got the throughput of the telescope's about 10 to 20% larger than what they thought it would be. So, they have all the design specs for the James Webb. And lo and behold, it's actually performing beyond its design specs, which doesn't surprise me that a lot of things that NASA builds do that. Even the Mars rovers, Spirit and Opportunity, they were designed to work for 30 days. They worked for the better part of a decade, so it was pretty phenomenal. Their pointing stability, I think, actually is what allows this sort of resolution, because instead of the telescope bouncing around by 6 milliarc seconds, it's only bouncing around by 1 milliarc second. And so that means that light is concentrated into a small region instead of being smeared out. And so the fascinating part of all of this is that we know the capabilities of what the Webb do. And you asked what sorts of planets would it be able to find. The statement they say is that given the improved performance, it will be possible to detect Uranus and Neptune massed objects beyond 100 to 200 astronomical units. So again, we're not talking solar system like planets, but it's incredibly impressive and a little bit discouraging at the same time. And even they say that they can get Saturn-sized objects down to about 10 astronomical units. And if you were to look at Alpha Centauri, which is one of the closest stars, it might be possible to push the limits down to where they can get to 5 times the Earth radius for companions that are 0.5 to 2.5 astronomical units. So you can see we're kind of getting down to where we can get that, to where we're actually measuring the light. And the reason why that's important, why we want to measure the light and what Webb brings to this that other telescopes don't, is that when you can measure the light, you now know what is the actual temperature of the planet. What does its atmosphere look like? What's the composition? You can start to do science on the planet instead of just saying, well, it's this massive.
So you could generate spectral information from the light then.
In principle, yes. Now, I'm not entirely sure whether it has that technology. You can see here, there's even some spectral information here because these are different wave bands.
Right. Oh, yeah, right.
It's just really wide wave bands. So you're right. Not going to be able to say, okay, let's look for the hydrogen line of such and such. It doesn't have that sort of resolution. But yeah, we're doing spectral spectroscopy on light from the planet itself, which is what you need to be able to assess whether this thing is really habitable. Because as much as Earth is a certain size, it's what's going on in the atmosphere is driving a whole lot of what makes Earth habitable.
Right. So hopefully you'd see something that is water or methane or, you know, some ammonia, oxygen, some kind of bands that would suggest the presence of those molecules then, right?
Those sorts of things you also might expect to see if there was a – like if you were observing Earth, there's changes in the amount of light output from the planet or from Earth because of the amount of cloud cover, because there's oceans and ice covered. And so if you had something which was – like ice on one side, water on the other side, you might detect the variability in the light output. These are the sorts of things you can start doing when you're measuring the light from the planet itself, not just how the planet affects the starlight. So it's exciting and fascinating. And before we can detect Earth-like planets around sun-like stars, we still have to wait for another couple telescopes. And for scale, the James Webb was proposed no later than about 1996. Mm. So we're 25 years later before we're starting to get the output from it. And so, you know, like I said, I don't want to be science can't do anything. This is just cool stuff. I mean, it's so impressive how the technology has advanced. And it's just a statement of how difficult the question is of assessing, are there planets capable of hosting life? Right. And we need to just bear that in mind when we're talking about, oh, we found the latest habitable planet. We really don't – we don't have the technology to get outside of, does it have the capacity to have the right temperature?
Right.
We don't even know what the right – whether it has that temperature or not. So it's a pretty challenging problem, but a fun problem to attack.
Yeah. So in terms of, you know, part of the bread and butter at Reasons to Believe is the idea that, you know, Earth is unique, our solar system is unique in terms of its habitability. Our sun is unique. You know, in other words, we don't really have the technology to really sufficiently probe that question experimentally. So we can do, you know, back of the envelope calculations or speculate on the uniqueness of the Earth from kind of counterfactual analyses or theoretical analyses. But what we really are saying is we don't have the experimental capacity to robustly go after that question, which means everybody should exercise some measure of humility, right?
Yes, yes. That's – and I would say it's a little – you can state it a little bit more – not definitively, or there is more data to weigh in. What we don't have is the capacity to go out and say, oh, here are these 5,000 planets. We know what their characteristics are, anything more than their mass and their orbital parameters. What we do have in our solar system is two planets that we would put in the habitable category beyond Earth, Venus and Mars. And so I think we get a whole lot more information about what sort of variability and things to look for by looking at those planets. We see that both Mars and Venus started out with an abundance of water. And yet Earth is the only one of the 3.5 billion years later that has any significant water on it. So we've got tools here to get a lot of details that really do illustrate the complex interactions of geophysics and atmospheric physics and biological physics and astronomical physics that are required to make a planet habitable. So I think there are things we can do to weigh in there. But we just need to have that caution when we're talking about, oh, we found a planet around an M dwarf. Well, we have to extrapolate from what we have here and recognize that there's kind of two schools of approach. One is, well, if we can get water, there's going to be life. And so all we need is this minimal set of characteristics to get water. That may actually be much harder than what we think. That's what kind of Venus and Mars tell us.
Right.
But even beyond that, just because you get water doesn't mean that water is going to stick around, or the water is going to have the necessary components, or the life can originate because there's too much ultraviolet. Not, I mean, there's all these other things at play. Right. And so let's just be a little cautious about what we're declaring to be based on observations around things that we just don't know. I mean, it's only been 25 years that we are now convinced that there are planets outside our solar system.
But then by the same token, too, we want to be a bit cautious saying, well, we found all these exoplanets, but yet none of them meet the capacities for life. So therefore, Earth is unique.
Exactly.
We want to be, you know, so it's caution on from both perspectives.
Exactly.
From both perspectives.
One of the things when I'm talking about this, I almost always will show a slide. It'll list all the exoplanets we found so far. And then I'll go put the planets out of our solar system on that graph. And what you'll find is that Jupiter fits in the class of, oh, we found Jupiter-sized planets that are similar to Jupiter in our solar system. Saturn just barely sits on the edge. Uranus, Neptune, Mercury, Earth, Venus are all down in this region where we just have no capacity to observe. And so we do need to be aware there's a selection effect in everything we found.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean you can't say anything, but I think, as you just said, we need to be cautious about what we say. Yeah. Well, thanks, Buzz. Appreciate our discussion today. And I want to thank you for joining us also today on Star, Cells, and God, and want to encourage you to join the discussion in the comments below. Remember to like this video and to subscribe for more content. New episodes of Star, Cells, and God release each Thursday and are available here on YouTube and on your favorite podcast app. Be sure to share this video with a friend. And remember, the more we know about science, the more we have reasons to believe.
The sound coming through, guys? Okay. Well, that was pretty good. One second, Dan. I don't have any questions coming in online, but, you know, we'll do our best here. If you have any, just go back to the mic and ask them. While we're waiting, I think the last, you noticed that was two talks. And by the way, the people speaking, Fuzz Rana, he's the new president and CEO of Reasons to Believe. And Jeff Zurich, he's astrophysicist, in-house scholar. So just in case you don't know. And Hugh is not the president anymore. But he's still staff there, one of the senior scholars. So the big thing that you should have got out of that was that what's been in the news lately, that James Webb telescope proves that there was no Big Bang. There was no beginning. Well, Jeff explained why that's not true, because first of all, it can't measure that type of phenomenon to tell whether there was a Big Bang or not. It can't measure the cosmic background radiation that was the only thing that existed when the universe was about 300,000 years old. It can't measure that. So it really isn't related to the Big Bang or to the beginning of the universe. Now, the other thing was the organoids. Any of you ever heard of those before, organoids? Something new, the biochemist, by the way, the other person was Dr. Fuzz Rana, I mentioned. He's a biochemist, and he talked about the organoids. In the lab, they've managed to take what he called pluripotent cells. Those are cells that can get out of your body, or they can take that are able to differentiate into any tissue. And so, or they can treat cells to do that. And they've treated them in such a way that they make little brains, little microscopic human brains. And, you know, there's an ethical question there, too. Should we be doing that? Are there souls in those? But the upside is that you can use those little organoid brains to do experiments. And so that's why he was talking about how those three particular proteins that humans have relate to cell division, and they keep it going real nice and clean. So there's no or few mutations. Whereas if you change those three proteins and you take them from a rat or Neanderthal or a chimp and put it into the human organoid, you can see that it causes mutations at a higher rate than if you use the human version of those three proteins. Pretty good. Okay, here's a couple friends of mine. I just brought him along since he was talking about humans and Neanderthals. This is a human skull. And I just want you to notice a couple things. Fuzz was talking about the brain, which is inside of the skull here, skull cavity. And he was talking about the gray matter, the convoluted area, neocortex, which is the outer part of the brain. And you notice in a human, I gotta face that camera there, there's a lot of room for neocortex. And it's right underneath the skull all the way back to here. And if you look at the Neanderthal, and this of course is a replica, the Neanderthal, I'm gonna put the mandible, the lower jaw down, pardon me. And look at the difference. If you look at the human, this is the human parietal bones are much higher. There's room for a lot of gray matter. In Neanderthal, it's lower. It's not as rounded as the human. And so there's less of that type of brain. By the way, the Neanderthal brain is larger than humans on average, but it's not neocortex so much. It's other parts of the brain. Neanderthal has a very large hind brain here, the cerebellum, for coordination, right in the back here. See how it sticks out in the back, this bun? In the human, of course, we have a cerebellum too, but it's smaller. Our brain is more dedicated to the neocortex, the rest of the material up here. So, if there's no other questions, I think we'll call it quits, and we're expecting Hugh back next week. I'm going to say a prayer to close us out, okay? Lord God, we thank you for this day. We praise and glorify you, Lord. And we thank you for the reasons to believe and the paradoxes class. Ask your blessing on our leader, our pastor, Hugh Ross, wherever he may be. Keep him safe and sound, and bring him back to us next week, healthy. Bless his family. Bless us, Lord, as we go from here, that we can keep you right in the forefront of our cerebral cortex, Lord. We ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.